This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross, who's off this week. Our guests, Rachel Maddow and Mike Yarvitz, have collaborated on a podcast called Bagman that tells the forgotten story of how a sitting vice president, Spiro Agnew, came under investigation by federal prosecutors, and before he was forced to resign, did everything to try and stay in office, including attacking the press and trying to shut down the investigation. There are several parallels relating to current investigations into President Trump. Agnew was Richard Nixon's first vice president, and he was being investigated for bribery and extortion in 1973, at the same time Nixon was a target of the Watergate investigation, which later led to Nixon's resignation. Rachel Maddow is the host of MSNBC's The Rachel Maddow Show. She hosts and co-wrote Bagman. Mike Yarvitz is a former senior producer of her show and produced and co-wrote Bagman. As part of his research, he listened to the Nixon White House tapes and to an audio diary made by Nixon's White House Chief of Staff, H.R. Haldeman. Yarvitz discovered some surprising, previously unreported twists in the story, including one way Agnew tried to get the U.S. attorney overseeing the investigation to stop it. The lead prosecutor, Barry Skolnick, never knew this part of the story until Yarvitz played him the Haldeman tape. As you'll hear on the podcast, Skolnick was stunned.
Well, we knew, we had some sense, as the whole country did, of what kind of administration Nixon with Haldeman and all Ehrlichman and so on were running, but we had no knowledge that this was happening.
Terry Gross spoke to Rachel Maddow and Mike Yarvitz last week.
Rachel Maddow, Mike Yarvitz, welcome to Fresh Air and congratulations on your podcast, which has now gotten over 10 million downloads. When thinking about questions surrounding President Trump, like did he obstruct justice? Did he commit impeachable offenses? Might we face a constitutional crisis? People tend to look at Richard Nixon and Watergate, but you've looked at his vice president, Spiro Agnew. What made you think about investigating Agnew?
For me, I feel like there are a lot of presidential scandals in U.S. history, but there are very few presidential scandals that result in resignation and or impeachment. And I was really interested in Agnew just because he's one of that very small number of presidential or vice presidential scandals that rose to that level, but also because I realized that when I tried to sort of thumbnail in my mind what happened in the Agnew resignation, everything I thought about it was wrong. All of my impressions about it turned out to be wrong when I looked them up. And for me, that piqued my curiosity.
I was almost embarrassed listening to your podcast because I knew so little. Like, I hadn't spent that much time thinking about why Agnew left office. And I was just shocked by everything I learned.
Well, that's not an uncommon thing. And I think Mike and I found that same dynamic at work, even as we had started working on the podcast. I mean, I assumed that his big sin was tax evasion. I had assumed that it was a Watergate-adjacent scandal, you know, that the FBI was looking into Watergate-related crimes and they stumbled upon something in Spiro Agnew's taxes. I had assumed that Agnew was kind of no big deal as a vice president because he's kind of no big deal in history. All of those things were completely wrong. The history of it is not what we remember, if we remember that history at all. And so it's nice to find something in history that's brand new.
Mike, before we get to what Agnew was guilty of, before we get to his bribery and extortion scheme, let's just give some background. Before serving as vice president, he'd been elected the Baltimore County Executive in 1962, then governor of Maryland in 66. What did Agnew represent politically when he was campaigning for vice president and when he became vice president? What did he represent on the right? Because he was kind of part of the culture war in the late 60s before the term culture war was coined.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think one of the interesting things that we found was that he really was this sort of firebrand figure on the right in a way that Nixon really wasn't. He sort of was able to rile up the conservative base across the country. He spoke in very controversial language at times about issues of race and, you know, law and order. I think one of the sort of interesting things that's, you know, sort of not known about Agnew as a political figure is how much, in a lot of ways, he was much more beloved among the Republican base, much more so than Nixon was. What sort of manifests itself during this scandal is that Nixon really sort of needs Agnew on his side because he knows, in a way, that Agnew is much more popular with the Republican base in the country than even he is. So I think the political history of Spiro Agnew as a political figure is sort of forgotten, but he did a lot to sort of raise these issues in the Republican base about antagonizing the media and these sort of these racial issues that had were sort of bubbling on the right in the 60s, and it's sort of a forgotten part of his legacy.
With the help of his speechwriter, William Safire, he said phrases like referring to his critics, calling them pusillanimous pussyfooters. Pusillanimous means lacking courage and resolution. He called his critics nattering nabobs of negativism. And there's a great quote that you use in the podcast. He said, "If you tell me that the hippies and the yippies are going to be able to do the job, I'll tell you this. They can't run a bus. They can't serve in governmental office. They can't run a lathe in a factory. All they can do is lay down in the park and sleep or kick policemen with razor blades." I mean, very, very provocative.
I would say he's provocative, but that attack on liberals, the attack in other instances on minorities, the attack on the elites, the attack specifically on the media, which he really turned into an art form, is something that was key not only to his controversial nature at the time, but it's absolutely what Nixon needed in terms of lining up and keeping on his side the very hardline Republican base at the time. And I think that was part of what was interesting in terms of parallels to today. I think a lot of people lament on the right the anti-media stuff that is stoked by the Trump administration, the anti-elite stuff, some of the divisive and racially specific stuff that we're seeing from this administration. But it's not new. It's a well-trod path, and Agnew was great at it.
Do you think Agnew kind of creates a new playbook for the kind of language you can use in campaign for high office?
I mean, he was really quite eloquent, actually, in his provocative and controversial remarks. I mean, Mike, one of the things I think, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but I feel like when we were going through his most controversial statements, one of the things that was sort of mind-bending for us, at least for me, was to be both seeing all the parallels to sort of Trumpist Republicanism today and to be seeing somebody who had this, you know, $20 million vocabulary and all the alliteration and all the eloquence, and he always spoke in complete sentences. I mean, that was kind of a disconnect for me.
So let's get to the bribery and extortion scheme that he was part of in Maryland. What was the scheme?
Yeah, essentially it was a scheme that he had concocted when he was Baltimore County executive, where he realized that he had the power to award some local contracts for engineering and architecture, and he could single-handedly decide who got the contract. And what he put together was a scheme that predated his time in that office, but he would arrange with these local contractors, engineers, and architects that they would get the contract, and in return, they would kick back to him something on the order of 3 to 5% of whatever they were making off of that contract. And these were kickbacks that were delivered to him in cash, often in an envelope that was just brought to him and handed to him directly. In many cases, he used a bagman as part of this scheme. And it was a scheme that he started when he was Baltimore County executive that he then continued when he was governor of Maryland. And again, he used a state roads commissioner when he was governor. And basically, it was a kickback scheme. It was a bribery and extortion scheme in which if you wanted a government contract in Maryland, you would have to kick back money to Spiro Agnew. And it was brazen, and it was delivered in cash. And he started that scheme in local politics, and then he carried it right into the White House.
So when Agnew finds out he's under investigation, he wants to shut it down. Before we get to the really big way he tries to shut it down, what are some of the smaller ways of attacking the people who are investigating him?
One of the first signs that the Baltimore prosecutors had that they were maybe onto something big that related to the vice president is that when Agnew heard that there was an investigation going on into public corruption in Baltimore County back in Maryland, he made himself available to the attorney general. He sort of importuned himself into the scandal himself, even before he had ever been named in conjunction with it. Actually, even before the attorney general knew that this investigation was going on, it hadn't risen to the level where the attorney general himself would be notified. So Agnew had his antenna up and knew that this was something that could get him in trouble. And so he got himself more in trouble by raising his hand and saying, hey, Mr. Attorney General, this investigation, this needs to stop. That was sort of prosecutor's first sign that maybe he was involved in it. That was not a genius move on Agnew's part. But then he continued efforts through the attorney general directly and ultimately through the U.S. attorney who was supervising the investigation in Maryland to pressure them into stopping the investigation simply because Agnew thought they should.
And one of the things that's interesting to see in terms of that strategy that Rachel's talking about is his effort to sort of behind the scenes cast these federal prosecutors as biased. He's sort of making an effort within the White House to say that these prosecutors are unprofessional and that they have political vendettas against him. And so as part of this obstruction effort, he is trying to sort of malign the character of the prosecutors who are in the process of investigating him.
That has a familiar ring to it.
Sure does.
So you found something, Mike, that the prosecutors didn't even know at the time, and that there was a secret plan that Agnew had to shut down the investigation. Would you describe that secret plan?
Yeah, you know, it's an interesting part of us digging into this story was looking through the Nixon White House recordings. And obviously, those recordings have been very picked over as it relates to Watergate, but not as picked over as it relates to the Agnew scandal. And what we found as we were sort of listening through the recordings was this effort that Spiro Agnew developed behind the scenes with Richard Nixon and with H.R. Haldeman and other White House officials to try to shut down this investigation that was being led by the U.S. attorney in Maryland, a man named George Beall. And the way that Agnew tried to do it was by getting to George Beall's brother, who was a sitting Republican senator from Maryland named Glenn Beall. And what you hear in these tapes is this really elaborate plan that Spiro Agnew is discussing in the Oval Office with Richard Nixon and others to basically get to this Republican senator behind the scenes and have him essentially get word to his brother to shut down this investigation. And as you mentioned, this was an obstruction effort that the prosecutors at the time didn't know about. And one of the surprising and amazing things to us as we were putting together this podcast was that even 45 years later, they weren't aware of it. And the reason that they weren't is because ultimately the obstruction effort didn't work. And George Beall, their boss, the U.S. attorney, was getting that pressure from his brother. And he shut it down.
He shut down the attempt to shut down the investigation.
That's right. That's right. He resisted that pressure that was coming at him from the Nixon White House and from his brother.
Okay. And in case anybody's finding the story hard to follow, so George Beall is the federal prosecutor in Maryland overseeing the investigation into Agnew. His brother is a Republican sitting senator from Maryland who's getting pressured from the White House. So the senator is being pressured to tell his brother, the prosecutor, shut it down.
And the other nice dynamic at work there is that George Beall's older brother, the U.S. senator, he really owed his Senate seat to Nixon and Agnew. Nixon and Agnew had weighed in very heavily during his election campaign to help him win that seat. George and Glenn, the brothers, their father had previously held that U.S. Senate seat. He had been ousted by a Democrat. Nixon and Agnew in the White House weighed in to help the Beall family, to help George Beall's older brother win that seat back that their father had previously held. The Beall family was absolutely indebted to the Nixon White House, to Agnew personally, because he campaigned for that Senate seat as a big figure in Maryland politics for them to win it. And so for then little brother George Beall to turn around and bring a prosecution against Agnew when his family was so politically and personally indebted to Agnew and when Agnew was reminding them of that at every turn and bringing all of these different Republican graybeards and important people to weigh in to try to pressure this investigation to stop. I mean, George Beall was a heroic figure here in the way that he resisted the pressure that was brought against him.
So once prosecutors understood Agnew's involvement in this bribery and extortion scandal, we had a president under criminal investigation, Richard Nixon, Watergate, and now a vice president under a completely separate criminal investigation. What was the unique set of problems that this presented for prosecutors?
I think the Justice Department, the Attorney General, Elliot Richardson, at the time, was already faced with the enormity of the prospect that the Watergate investigation would lead to the end of the Nixon presidency, whether he was somehow prosecuted, whether he resigned, whether the pressures of the Watergate investigation were somehow going to end his presidency one way or another. That was already such an almost, you know, sort of politically apocalyptic scenario that they were facing. They were blindsided when they were confronted by the evidence that Agnew was also existentially challenged as a senior figure in the federal government because of his own totally unrelated scandal. And the prospect that you would lose Nixon somehow, that Nixon would have to leave the presidency, but then Agnew would ascend to the presidency because he was the vice president, even though the Justice Department was well aware that he was under serious criminal investigation. He was potentially facing a 40-count criminal indictment. That, I think, was a terrifying and totally unique prospect in U.S. history. I mean, theoretically, what that could have resulted in is Nixon leaving office or being forced from office because of the criminal scandal that was Watergate, him being succeeded immediately by a vice president who was under a completely separate criminal investigation, who was then also forced from office relatively quickly because of that same sort of criminal liability that his predecessor had faced. At that point, would President Agnew have even had a chance to nominate a new vice president who would then be confirmed by the Senate, who would then succeed him? Would you end up with the Democratic Speaker of the House ascending to the presidency because all of these dominoes were falling too quickly for the line of succession to be restored fully? I mean, the prospect of the chaos at the top of the federal government was just unparalleled.
And the fear of that kind of chaos drove the prosecutor's approach to dealing with Agnew. Would you explain how?
These young prosecutors in Baltimore who actually put together all the evidence that nailed Agnew, they built a slam dunk case against him. They wanted Agnew to go to jail. They wanted Agnew to be treated like a public official on the take, somebody who'd been caught for public corruption and had to pay for it. It was Elliot Richardson, the attorney general, who decided that the priority could not be individual justice for Spiro Agnew, the criminal. The priority could not be Agnew being put in jail. It was Richardson who decided that the priority for the country had to be Agnew out of the line of succession, that the most important and, in fact, the unitary goal of this prosecution had to be his removal from office. He had to no longer be vice president because that was more important to the country than whether or not he faced individual justice. The prosecutors were very mad about it at the time, but Richardson believed it was the right thing to do.
So what was Richardson's approach to removing Agnew from office?
Well, Richardson and his prosecutors engaged in a lengthy series of negotiations with Agnew's own legal team about what they were going to do with this evidence of criminal behavior on the part of the vice president. And this, is, to me, is where you get into some of the most important and fuzzy implications of the end of Agnew as vice president of the United States. Because the Agnew legal team was maintaining publicly that Agnew as vice president was immune from prosecution, that he couldn't be indicted. The Office of Legal Counsel, the Justice Department at the time, was asked to weigh in on this matter, and they produced a sort of strange memo which said, well, the president can't be indicted, but the vice president can. Sort of a odd duck, that memo. But on the basis of that opinion, the attorney general and these prosecutors went to Agnew's legal team and said, hey, we can indict you, and we intend to, and what do you have to trade for that? And those negotiations went on for a long time, and they were complex and important, but ultimately the deal that was reached was that Agnew would only have to plead no contest to one count. He wouldn't do any jail time, but he would have to resign immediately.
And what was the count that he pled to?
He pled to tax evasion, but he didn't plead guilty. He pled no contest.
So this is why when people think about Agnew leaving office, they just think of like, oh, tax fraud.
Mm-hmm. And they think, yeah, he got caught fiddling something with his deductions.
Mm-hmm,
no.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it was such a bigger story.
Yeah.
Rachel, you retweeted presidential historian Michael Beschloss's tweet, And it's very relevant to the conversation that we're having. Beschloss tweeted, Nixon on Watergate in State of the Union 45 years ago this month. Quote, I believe the time has come to bring that investigation and the other investigations of this matter to an end. 1 year of Watergate is enough! Exclamation point. That sounds familiar.
Yeah. It is amazing how much the history rhymes here. I mean, we don't do anything exactly twice, but the parallels with what was going on in the Nixon and Agnew administration 45 years ago to the efforts by the Trump administration right now to parry this investigation and these swirling scandals around this presidency, it is uncanny. The attacks on the press, the attacks on the Justice Department, the efforts to undermine the independence of the Justice Department, the attacks on individual prosecutors, the effort to claim publicly that there's something improper about the length of the investigation. All of these things have direct parallels in the Agnew scandal and in Watergate. And we know how it ended, both for Nixon and Agnew, but that doesn't mean it's going to necessarily end the same way now. History is informative but not determinative in terms of what happens next. I do feel like it helps to understand that even though it feels like a lot of what we're going through is unprecedented or worse than we can possibly imagine, the more you know about previous scandals in U.S. history, the more you realize that some of this stuff is not unprecedented and that we have not only been confronted with some of these same problems and crises in the past, we've survived them and done so in a way that we can be proud of in terms of the way that our democracy handled challenges. And Agnew's case, because of some heroic individuals and because the system held and because of, you know, some historical accidents in terms of the way things worked out, I think the Agnew story is really helpful to understanding the way the system works when it confronts bad behavior by people in high office. We are capable of dealing with that as a country in a way that makes us proud of the people who are in public office who are dealing with it.
I just want to say in conclusion to our listeners, we just touched on some of the story that's told in Bagman. There's a lot more story in it and really interesting clips as well. So the podcast is called Bagman, and my guest Rachel Maddow co-wrote it with Mike Yarvitz, the producer of the podcast, and Rachel, of course, also hosts her own show on MSNBC weekday nights at 9 o'clock. Thank you both so much for talking with us.
Terry, thank you so much. This was a ton of fun. Thank you.
Thanks, Terry. It was an honor.
Terry Gross speaking with Rachel Maddow and Mike Yarvitz about their podcast, Bagman. Our film critic Justin Chang has a review of M. Night Shyamalan's new film, Glass. It's a direct sequel to two of his previous movies, his 2000 superhero drama Unbreakable and his 2017 multiple personality thriller Split. The story unfolds in the director's hometown of Philadelphia and continues the adventures of three characters played by returning cast members, Bruce Willis, Samuel L. Jackson, and James McAvoy, who are gifted with extraordinary powers. Here's Justin.
Few filmmakers are as committed to their own preposterousness as M. Night Shyamalan, and after seeing his alternately tortured and inspired new thriller Glass, I'm not sure whether to be sad or grateful. It's an eccentric, ambitious, perilously self-indulgent sequel that braids together two of his previous movies, Split, his recent freakout starring James McAvoy as a serial kidnapper with a severe case of dissociative identity disorder, and Unbreakable, his melancholy 2000 drama with Bruce Willis as a shatterproof superhero. Welcome, in other words, to the Shyamalan cinematic universe, a realm of rug-pulling twists and elaborately contrived mythologies, where coincidences don't exist and every childhood trauma is an origin story in the making. Unbreakable, as you may know, gave us an origin story for Bruce Willis's character, David Dunn, but also for his nemesis, Elijah Price, a brittle-boned comic book obsessive turned maniacal mass murderer. Samuel L. Jackson is back as Elijah, who now goes by Mr. Glass and has spent almost 2 decades in a Philadelphia psychiatric hospital. His quarters are about to get a lot more crowded. As the movie opens, David has embraced his vigilante hero identity. He walks the streets in a hooded poncho, sniffing out evil telepathically. It doesn't take him long to track down James McAvoy's villain, who goes by Kevin Wendell Crumb, but has 23 different names and personalities, the most fearsome of which is the Beast, a wall-crawling monster with an awesomely ripped torso. Shortly after David rescues four teenage girls from Kevin's lair, the two men are apprehended by police and thrown into the asylum with Elijah, where they are studied by Dr. Ellie Staple, a psychiatrist played by an intense Sarah Paulson. Her theory is that David, Kevin, and Elijah are not, in fact, superhuman beings, and that their seemingly extraordinary capabilities have perfectly rational explanations. But Elijah knows better. At one point, he reassures Kevin, or rather, Patricia, one of Kevin's multiple personalities, whose job is to protect him from harm.
What's upsetting you, Patricia?
What if he can't do these extraordinary things? What if he is just unwell? Like you?
Everything extraordinary can be explained away, and yet it is true. I think deep down you know this. Everything we will see and do will have a basis in science, but it will have limits. This is the real world, not a cartoon. And yet some of us don't die from bullets. Some of us can still bend steel. That is not a fantasy.
Dr. Staple tells David, Kevin, and Elijah that they are suffering from a delusion of grandeur, which might be Shyamalan having a joke at his own expense. Since his phenomenal success with The Sixth Sense 20 years ago, he's had one of the more erratic Hollywood careers, marked by high-profile duds and a very public fall from grace. He scored a comeback hit with Split 2 years ago, which suggested that his knack for audacious storytelling hadn't entirely abandoned him. Glass does make good on some of Split's promise, despite its workmanlike action sequences. All those alter egos allow McAvoy to deliver another over-the-top acting tour de force, while Willis's dependable heroics and Jackson's subtle villainy provide a welcome counterbalance. Unbreakable fans will appreciate the emotional continuity of having Charlaine Woodard and Spencer Treat Clark reprise their roles as Elijah's mother and David's son 19 years later. Also back for more is the remarkable Anya Taylor-Joy, who was resilient enough to survive Kevin's kidnapping spree in Split, though here she has the icky, Stockholmish task of trying to reconnect with her former captor. Eventually, David, Kevin, and Elijah find a way to escape their prison and wage war. Against each other, perhaps, but also against a world that will always fear and persecute them because of their powers. Shyamalan's lesson is that superheroes are real, our stories are all connected, and whatever makes you different is also what makes you awesome. It's an inspiring message, but it doesn't feel like the stuff of Revelation. The recent Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse succeeded against all reason in revitalizing the superhero genre and turning its derivative qualities into a clever meta-joke. But while Shyamalan has his own scholarly affection for fanboy culture, he even sets a few scenes in an old-school comic book store, his approach to the material feels belabored and obvious by comparison. He still knows how to build tension inside the frame, how to take your breath away with a simple camera move, but he also insists on stuffing earnest pronouncements into his characters' mouths, dishing out explanatory flashbacks like candy, and giving himself another painfully pointless directorial cameo. Whether you see this glass as half full or half empty is entirely up to you, but there's no mistaking it for the work of anyone else.
Justin Chang is Fresh Air's film critic and a film critic for the LA Times. Coming up, John C. Reilly talks about playing Oliver Hardy and bringing some classic Laurel and Hardy comedy routines to life in the new film Stan and Ollie. This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross, who's off this week. Our next guest, John C. Reilly, earned a Golden Globe nomination for Best Actor in a Comedy or a Musical for his performance in the new film Stan and Ollie about the comedy duo Laurel and Hardy. Last year, Reilly earned critical acclaim for his role with Joaquin Phoenix in the Western The Sisters Brothers. Reilly's appeared in more than 70 films, including Boogie Nights, Magnolia, Chicago, Talladega Nights, Walk Hard, The Dewey Cox Story, and Step Brothers. For Stan and Ollie, Riley had to wear heavy prosthetics to play the 280-pound Oliver Hardy. The film explores Hardy's relationship with his partner, Stan Laurel, in their older years, as Laurel and Hardy try to revive their sagging career with a stage show tour in England. Here's a scene from late in the film when they finally had a successful performance in London. They're backstage after the show, with people waiting for them downstairs at a party. But they start working on ideas for a scene for their next movie. Steve Coogan plays Stan Laurel. John C. Reilly as Oliver Hardy speaks first.
The line that Robin Hood has about stealing from the rich and giving to the poor. There's a gag there somewhere, isn't there?
Babe, the girl's going to be waiting for us downstairs. Delphon wants us to meet these people from his charity.
Never mind about them. They're not going anywhere. We just need to work through this just a little bit more. Hey, when is Muffin coming to see the show?
He didn't say.
He should have been here tonight. Went big tonight. That was a crackerjack, wasn't it?
It was.
All right. How about this? How about we tell Robin Hood, you've got it all wrong. You ought to steal from the poor and giving to the rich or something like that.
That's not right. No,
it's... Well, what is it?
Well, all right.
Okay. Well, you got something.
How about this? Okay, how about this? Okay, I tap you on the shoulder and I say, Ollie, I got an idea. How about we give to the poor by stealing from the poor? That way we cut out the middleman.
That's it. That's it.
All right.
Stealing from the rich to give to the poor. Whoever heard of such a ridiculous idea?
Well, it's communism.
Well, John C. Reilly, welcome back to Fresh Air. Congratulations on the film and your Golden Globe nomination.
Thank you very much. Good to be back.
I watched Laurel and Hardy movies as a kid on television. This is a kind of a physical comedy that I guess is a holdover in part from the silent era, which their careers overlapped with. It's not slapstick exactly, but it struck me that watching you and Coogan doing some of their routines, that it required an awful lot of careful timing. I mean, like there's, you know, a bit with two doors where you're trying to find each other at a train station and manage to miss each other. Talk a little bit about getting that kind of comedy to work.
That is the really interesting part of the story of Laurel and Hardy, is that they started as silent comedians in the silent era. And when the movie business transitioned into the sound era, it left a lot of people behind. And Stan Laurel actually specifically talked about this transition. He said, you know, a lot of performers who were silent performers, when they got the chance to speak on film, you know, a lot of those filmmakers would fill the movies with dialogue from beginning to end because everyone was so excited about being able to talk on film. And Stan Laurel thought, very wisely, you know what, we're doing this silent stuff very well. Let's not throw out the baby with the bathwater. Let's try to keep doing what we do really well. And where dialogue will enhance what we're doing, let's have dialogue. And so they were kind of stingy with their dialogue, even when they moved into the sound era, which really... It helped them a lot because it made them keep doing what they were doing so well already. The brilliant thing about their work, when you watch it, it seems so nonchalant. It seems like they're doing it for the first time. And you know that some of these routines, like the double door routine you mentioned in our movie, where we keep missing each other, going out one door, coming out, there's two, like a waiting room and a railway station is the way we did it on stage. And in order to get that comedy to look right, so it just looks like we're just accidentally missing each other 15 times in a row. In order to do that, it requires this diligence with the timing. And it's almost like a ballet or a piece of music that you're playing when you're doing it. Because what looks like very nonchalant, just kind of like normal human behavior from the outside, inside is Steve and I going 5, 4, 3, 2, turn, wait, 2, 3, turn, right? So it's almost like this choreographed thing in our mind.
You had to be a fat guy in this movie. I mean, you had to go through a lot to get the physical look of Oliver Hardy. And I got to say, it's pretty remarkable because you don't look like a guy wearing a fat suit. You really look like a fat guy. I mean, you know, your hands are beefy. And what was the physical transformation? What did it consist of?
You know, the truth is I thought of myself as looking very different than Oliver when I started this process, and that was one of the things that I was really nervous about. I thought, I don't want it to be some bad makeup job or like you said, to look like some guy in a fat suit. Like, I really want this movie to feel very, very human and real. So that transformation, yeah, that was one of the first things that was like, it was almost like a door being opened for me. When I saw the mock-ups of the computer, you know, they do these computer-generated kind of mock-ups of what the makeup will look like
right. Before
they actually do it. And when I saw the first mock-up from Marc Coulier, who's like an award-winning prosthetic makeup designer, when I first saw those pictures, I thought, wow, maybe I can do this. Maybe I can, because I will look like the guy. I know that now.
And did it restrict your movements, either your facial movements? I mean, you have to dance in this thing, right? I mean,
yeah, you know, I had to wear this cooling suit underneath it, which was like a T-shirt filled with plastic tubes. And then you plug those tubes into like a cooler with a pump in it that has ice water in it. And it cycles ice water all around your body and the inside of the suit. Look, I've never done hard drugs, but I have a feeling that it feels a little bit like that cooling suit coming on, you know, because after you've done that Way Out West dance a few times in that fat suit and that makeup, you plug that thing in, it was like, ah, and it was literally keeping me alive, because if you work that hard and you're that covered up, your body will get heat stroke and you'll just shut down. So that cooling suit really saved my life. But no, it didn't restrict my movements at all, actually. In fact, I had them add weight to the inside of that foam suit that I was in so that I would always have an awareness of what I was carrying, you know?
Yeah. There was a point when Oliver did a film without Stan because their contracts didn't expire at the same time with the studio, and there was some ongoing resentment. I wonder if we should play the scene where there's the real confrontation between the two of you. Maybe we should listen to that. You want to set this up? This is at a reception in England, right?
Yeah, so Oliver and Stan have just done, you know, all this work to get their tour going. They finally get a big show put together in London. They have one of the most successful nights of the entire tour, and afterwards, this betrayal from the past is brought up in conversation, and it's when Stan and Ollie both realize, like, wait a minute, we do have some unfinished business here, and they really let each other have it in a way that they haven't done before.
So let's listen to this. This is Steve Coogan and our guest John C. Reilly in the film Stan and Ollie, and this is Stan Laurel and Oliver Hardy arguing. It begins with Stan bringing up the fact that Oliver Hardy had done a film without him years before and what and how much it hurt him. Let's listen.
I couldn't sleep for days when they told me what you did, and I couldn't sleep when I did it. But you still did it. You betrayed me. Betrayed our friendship.
Friendship? We're friends because Hal Roach put us together. And the only reason we stayed together was because the audience wanted it. I have real friends. And yes, we play golf. And we go to ball games. And we have sauerkraut on our bratwurst.
People will remember our movies long after you've finished your hot dog. You know something? You're just a lazy ass who got lucky because you met me.
Lucky? To spend my life with a hollow man who hides behind his typewriter? You're not real, Stan. You're hollow. You're empty.
I loved us.
You loved Laurel and Hardy, but you never loved me.
So what?
And that's Steve Coogan and our guest John C. Reilly from their new film, Stan and Ollie. You know, it's striking listening to that, and I'm hearing your voice as we're having this conversation, and I hear the voice of you as Oliver Hardy, and boy, you can really hear the transformation.
Well, partly it's because I'm fighting a cold today, Dave, so my voice probably sounds a lot different than a lot of my performances, but yeah, I appreciate your noticing the transformation there. In a way, it was like every morning when I would have that makeup put on, because I was wearing brown contact lenses also and a wig, and like this whole thing was applied to me every day. And it's almost like by the end of that process, I didn't have a choice whether to be myself. I was this other person. I had a little party for the crew at my house at the end of the shooting, and I kept having all these weird conversations with people on the crew at this party. And finally, I turned to someone like, why is everyone acting kind of like strange with me? Like,
I know these people. I've been working with them for 3 months. And finally, the director said, John, you got to understand, most of these people have never seen you outside of the makeup and all that. They've never seen you with blue eyes. They've never seen you with that 100 pounds off of you. It's a little weird, you know, meeting you for the first time after working with you for 3 months. So that was interesting. The transformation, you know, it was like working inside of a mask that your whole body was in a way.
You also had a film out this year, The Sisters Brothers, about two contract killers in the 1850s, guys who carried guns in the Pacific Northwest. It's based on a novel by Patrick DeWitt, and I guess this was really kind of your project. You and your wife fell in love with the novel and got the film going a long time ago, right? What appealed to you about this story?
Well, it's a brilliant book. I mean, it takes place in the West, but it's not about cowboys and Indians, and it's not about the good guys and white hats. It's about all these morally ambivalent characters and these men trying to find a new way to be a human being and the dawn of civilization, or at least the next chapter of American civilization. There's all kinds of refreshing, really original ideas in there that I had never seen in that genre before. So it was a no-brainer in terms of trying to make it into a film. It took a while to do it, but eventually we hooked up with the great Jacques Audiard, who is one of the best filmmakers in the world, and then we were off to the races.
There are a couple of details I wanted to ask you about. One is the scene where you're lying down to sleep. You sleep outside, and a spider, tarantula, crawls into your mouth, and I guess you swallow it. That looks so real. How did you shoot that?
Well, I had to hold very still. The spider that we use is actually not a venomous spider. It looks really scary, but it's not a trained spider. It was a spider wrangler. I would just sort of lay there and then close my mouth. And then as soon as they cut the camera, open my mouth, and they get the spider out of my mouth.
So that was a real spider crawling into your mouth?
Yeah. No, of course it wasn't. It was CGI. But isn't it interesting, Dave, that we are now having this conversation, that you are watching a special effect in the movie and you can't tell? In other words, if I tell you it's a real spider, you believe that it's a real spider. It's almost like the robots have won. You know, we're now at a place with special effects where you literally just have to know the behind-the-scenes truth in order to detect it. And I think that's a really exciting moment in filmmaking, when the illusion becomes so complete that we can no longer tell what is illusion and what is real. That, in a way, that is like movies coming into their own. In the past, with these kind of things, you would kind of go, well, that's a computer effect, or right. or that's a rubber spider. Of course, they couldn't get a real spider to do that. Now we've gotten to a place in film where the effects are so good that, you know,
okay,
the illusion is complete. Okay. There was no real spider. Let me be clear. Pulling your leg before to make a point. There was no real spider.
All right.
No spiders were harmed in the making of The Sisters Brothers.
You've had a lot of great work lately. You're nominated for a Golden Globe. Anything you haven't done you want to do?
Well, is this when I say direct? That's sort of the elephant in the room after doing almost 80 movies and working with some of the greatest directors in the world. I should know something about how to put a movie together at this point. So I've directed a lot of plays, and I think I might do that next. And if a movie comes along that it seems like I'm the only person who could direct it, then maybe that, yeah. We'll see.
We'll see what unfolds. Yeah,
I've directed a lot of kids' plays so far, and that's been a very rewarding, and it's been a great way to learn how to work with people who are trying to come into their own as actors. I've done a lot of kids' plays in my children's schools, and I'm hoping that those will be a great training ground for for working with adults one day.
You've directed kids' plays at your children's schools?
Yeah, yeah.
What do you think you've learned from directing kids?
I've learned, well, it gives you an appreciation for what it means to be a director. It gives you an appreciation for the responsibilities and the role, you know, as a leader. I've been someone who's always been more comfortable not being the leader. I've been someone who's like, I'm a very loyal soldier, but I don't like being the general. haven't liked the responsibility of saying, no, this is what we should do. I know I'm right. You know, I've always been someone who's much more collaborative and adaptive to situations, but directing plays has taught me, you know, you have a really important role as a leader here. And even if you're scared or even if you feel like, oh, God, this is not going well, you cannot show that to them. You have to be this, you know, you have to be the fearless leader, the one who's saying, like, don't worry, you can do it. Even when inside you're thinking, like, I'm not quite sure they can do it. You have to be the one saying, don't worry, you can do it. And, yeah, I'm not quite there yet in terms of fully embracing that leadership kind of mentality, but I do, the older I get, I look around me and think, like, well, I still feel like a 12-year-old kid, but I guess I'm the adult in the room now. You know, I go onto a movie set, Dave, these days, and I'm the oldest person on the set by far, not just the other actors, but the entire crew. You know, filmmaking is kind of a young person's game in terms of the behind the scenes, you know, the work that needs to be done. So the older I get, the more I'm kind of like settling into this place of like, well, you know, maybe you do have something worth saying. Maybe you do have some earned authority at this point. But the confidence it takes to be a director and to be a leader and to be responsible for other people's paths is not one that I take lightly. So, yeah, that's something I think you have to be ready to do, because once you do say you're going to do it, there are a lot of people really depending on you for that leadership, and you can't let them down. Yeah, we'll see. We'll see. I'm hoping to at least to develop more things for myself and produce more things. And I mean, look, the truth is, I want to do everything I can do in this life. I want to give everything I can. I don't want to die thinking like, oh, I should have done that or I should have done this. I want to leave it all on the stage, and maybe directing will be one of those things that comes my way.
John C. Reilly, it's great to have you back. Thanks so much.
My pleasure, Dave. Thank you.
John C. Reilly co-stars with Steve Coogan in the new film Stan and Ollie. Fresh Air Weekend is produced by Teresa Madden. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director and engineer this week is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shorrock, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, Heidi Simon, Muj Zaidi, Thea Challoner, and Seth Kelly. Molly C.V. Nesper is our associate producer of digital media. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.